Good morning and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This morning we'll take a wee break from all the counting and recounting of ballots and pushes from the right and the left. Instead, we're going to hear from a Vermont folk singer who has traveled the world spreading joy and music. We'll learn about an organization helping our kids learn to love reading. And we'll talk to two food writers who will make sure we have some great options for eating as we head into the oncoming winter of COVID. And now, since Wednesday is Veterans Day, we want to begin the week and the show by talking about the role that Vermont and so many Vermonters have played in defending our country. There's a special place at Camp Johnson in Colchester that commemorates these individuals. It's the Vermont National Guard Library and Museum, and it is open to the public, and it is a gem. Joining us to talk about it is Museum President Dick Lorenz. Good morning, Dick.
Hey, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm fabulous. And John Danley, he is the museum's docent. John, great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Morning, Rick. Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And listeners, feel free to join the conversation. Give us a call at 802-244-1777. Toll free, the number is 1-877-291-8255. Have you visited the Vermont Military Museum? Or do you have a question about Vermonters who served in any of the country's military conflicts? You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Dick, give us a little background on how the museum got started.
Well, I've been with them for about 7 years, so relative to the age of the museum, I'm a newcomer. But it started about 40 years ago by a couple of people on Camp Johnson that literally was in the closet going way back when, and they had a few artifacts. It then moved from there into a cinder block building inside the confines of the camp and stayed there until about 25 years ago, when the National Guard generously donated two buildings that we're currently housed in and has given us a presence to the public that we never had before. Everything in the museum has been built and donated by Vermonters and completely staffed by volunteers. Over the years, they have done a magnificent job. Some of them are actually still with us today as volunteers.
Wow.
It is quite a gem, and encourage everybody to come take a look and see what's here.
And just give us kind of an overview. There are so many things in there, but what will people find at the museum?
They're going to find out in the out in the yard. I call it the yard. We have some armored vehicles. We have some aircraft: F-16, T-33, F-94. We have some Russian spoils of war. They call them. Artillery pieces, et cetera, et cetera. Inside the museum, however, we have a couple of really special holdings. One is a mural that was painted by Charles Andrus back about 1890, and it depicts the Battle of Cedar Creek, which occurred during the Civil War down in the Shenandoah Valley in October of 1864. That shows how the Vermont Regiment was taken down there by General Sheridan and confronted the Confederates as they made their way across the Shenandoah Valley. The battle that occurred that day was significant in causing the end of that war, and the Vermonters were the ones that played the major role in that. Depicted in that same painting is none other than George Custer, happened to be there that day. It's quite a piece. It's been that mural has been with us, I think, since about 30 years ago. It was donated here by the great-grandniece of Charles Andrus, and she lived in Shelburne until her demise a couple of years ago and is donated to the National Guard.
It is a stunning piece. Yeah, it really is stunning. Is that the same artist who's done the painting in the Cedar Creek room at the state capitol?
No, I forget his name, but it is not the same one. They look very much the same. The one in the state capitol is slightly bigger than this one. But the one we have, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's like 27 feet by 18 feet high or something like that. It's quite a piece.
It's a great compliment.
It's the single largest piece of art. I'm sorry,
that's
art material that produced at the
Yeah, really is amazing. John Danley, what do you hope visitors will learn when they and what they'll take from their visit to the museum?
I think basically an understanding of Vermonters' role in military history and their attachment to the Army and Air Force Guard, which is one of our three areas that we try to focus on. Besides military history and the history for the region, it's just an idea of, you know, how important the Vermonters themselves and their service have been, and the area itself in the history of the country.
My brother, who's an Army veteran, stopped in to your museum when he was visiting Vermont, and he came home. And he implored me, you have to go to this place. He just kept regaling me with stories of Vermont's role in the military and things that were developed here. And so he's a veteran, but who enjoys visiting the museum, John?
It seems like the young kids seem to have the most fun. You know, they somehow drag their grandparents or parents in with them. And they just have a good time. There's a lot of good visual things for them to see, things they can relate to, you know, pictures, you know, large cannons and stuff, things that, you know, like that kids would get you know, overawed by. But then they start realizing that you know, the things that point out history and what their parents or grandparents may have been in. It's fun to watch. Kids do like it. Then you have the veterans that come in that relate to certain things that they've been through, but then realize other things that they hadn't, like the history of Vermont and its importance during the American Revolution, the War of 1812, Civil War, things that they basically heard of it in a broad sense, but didn't realize that how important the contribution of Vermont and Vermonters were to the nation's history.
Dick Lorenz, who can visit? And I know, you know, you have to go to Camp Johnson, so how do you navigate that Camp Johnson gatehouse?
That's a very good question. It appears intimidating, but it really isn't.
Right.
We are located directly across from Fannie Allen Hospital, most people know. And all you do when you come in, you stay in the left-hand lane, you approach the gate, and you have to have some ID, your driver's license, just let the guard know that you're coming to the museum, and he'll just direct you to us, and we're directly across from the gatehouse to the right. Very, very simple, very easy to come in. But I should say with the COVID that you need to be wearing a mask as you approach the gate as well.
All right. Is there any cost? And then what hours, days is the museum open?
Well, that's a good. It is absolutely free to the public, and it's open Monday through Friday, from 10 to 3, and we're staffed with volunteers during that period of time.
I'm speaking with Dick Lorenz. He's president of the Vermont National Guard Library and Museum. Also, John Danley, the museum docent. If you'd like to join the conversation, our numbers are 244-1777. Toll free, it's 1-877-291-8255. Or 291-TALK. And Dick mentioned those pieces outside of the museum. That's really kind of the arresting thing you see as you're driving up or strolling by. And so, John, why don't you tell us, you know, maybe about a piece or two that really is something of note out there.
Out in the front?
Yeah.
We have several tanks. But basically, they're tanks and artillery pieces that kind of show the recent history of the Vermont Army National Guard, things that they have been using that they've donated to the museum. At one time, the Army National Guard, within the last 20, 30 years, was an artillery unit. So they'll have a howitzer out there. Prior to that or after that, it was an armor unit. So there's a couple of representative tanks that at the M48 and M60. There's also early model M1 Abrams, when it was a 105-millimeter gun. Then we also have some captured Russian stuff and some World War II stuff that it's still been hanging around the base, including the M7 Priest howitzer. So there's a number of things out there that will get interest of people who like military equipment.
Not knowing either of your backgrounds in the military, any of those pieces that you might have actually been in or operated while you did your military service, either of you?
It's funny you mentioned that. The T-33, which is the 1950s era aircraft, was actually a trainer aircraft, and I flew in that as an ROTC student on an orientation flight when I was attending St. Michael's College.
Oh, my gosh.
And that rested my grounds today.
Oh, I love it. That's great to hear. Well, Dick, once inside, what is the best plan of attack to enjoy the museum?
When you come in, we'll greet you at the door. And as you come in, you go to your left, and you kind of walk around through a contiguous historical displays, starting at the Revolutionary War, and it brings you around through the different eras there, War of 1812, Korean War, World War II, of course, and then through Iraq and Afghanistan. One piece I failed to mention earlier, that one of our larger holdings, is what we call the Merci Train.
Yes.
Which is a rail car that was donated, was given to the United States after World War II in 1949. Every state of the Union received one of these rail cars from France as a token of their appreciation for our support of them both during both wars as well as their support of them after World War II. In 1947, the United States formed what they called a Freedom Train, which ran around the country, this country, gathering foodstuffs to be donated to Europe, in particular France, to help them recover from the war. In return, France sent one of these rail cars to every state of the Union, and we have the one here. It arrived in Montpelier in 1949, found different homes in White River Junction, St. Albans, and eventually found a home inside of us about 30 years ago. It's in pristine condition. The significance of the rail car is these rail cars is how they carried the troops to the front lines in both World War I and World War II. So it has some meaning to some people. We have a volunteer who just turned 95 years old who actually rode in one of these rail cars in the Battle of the Bulge during World War II.
Oh, my.
So it has a presence. And there's a whole bunch of people throughout the world that follow these trains and visit them. We've had people come from Denmark and the Philippines and Japan simply to see the rail car. So it has quite a following throughout the world, in the United States in particular.
And I can definitely attest it is worth going to the museum just to see that. But there's so much more. There are so many different military conflicts that are covered in this building. But take us to one that you really are passionate about and maybe give us some indication of Vermont's role in it.
Vermont's role, there's one display of the 172nd Infantry Regiment, which is a Vermont National Guard unit. It was called up in 1940, and they were merged into the 43rd Infantry Division and sent over to the South Pacific in 1942. And so the infantry regiment was made up all of Vermonters, and there's a display we have in it showing their arrival into the South Pacific at Espiranto Santo, the harbor, which was a forward base in the Solomon areas. And when the ship came in, which was the USS Calvin Coolidge, it hit a mine. And there's six photographs of what happened to the ship after it hit the mine, of it sinking. And so very good photographs showing all these Vermonters scampering out of the ship as it literally sank in the harbor. You can see them getting into boats. And if you look at the photographs, you got to realize those are all Vermonters. Wow. And luckily, only two people died in this accident. One was a seaman in the boiler room, I guess, where the mine hit. And the mine turned out to be a U.S. mine that they just didn't happen to give the chart to the ship's captain, so he didn't know where the mines were in the harbor. So and you see all those Vermonters, and he said, well, I'm glad. As you see them in the water, hanging on the life rafts and stuff, you're just glad that they survived that incident.
Absolutely.
The very dramatic last photograph just shows a big bubble where the ship went down in the harbor.
Mm. Dick, you mentioned that train, but when someone comes in, is there anything else that you want to make sure that they see when they're at the museum?
Yes, I do. We talked about the artifacts that we have here and some of the holdings, but we also have remembrances of some of our veterans that served in World War II and other conflicts. As you and I talked, Rick, about some, we have what is called the Vermonters Wall of Fame, where we highlight individuals from Vermont and their history in in the military, particularly from World War II, but some afterward. We also have a wall that's called the Medal of Honor Wall. Vermont has the distinction of holding more medals of honor than any other state, 50 to be exact, and most of them came from the Civil War. So we recognize them, and there's a book there. You can go by name to see who they are, what their history was. There's one other person that was a volunteer up until about 3 years ago. His name is Jack Goss, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. We have a POW, Prisoner of War, remembrance of him. He was a B-25 pilot in World War II, resident of South Burlington. And he was shot down and was held captive by the Germans in Stalag 3, I think, for 2 years. And he eventually got released and by the Russians and the Americans and came home. And so we have his whole story, and his diary is included here. So you can see actually what he went through, both as a bomber pilot as well as a prisoner of war in the German camp. It's quite fascinating reading.
Yeah, that Wall of Fame really does captivate people. I know there are two people on that wall, Don Jones of Middlesex, who flew the F-100 Misties into North Vietnam, very dangerous missions, and another one, Moncton dairy farmer Roger Lane, who was also held in a German concentration camp after being shot down. And I've had the honor of interviewing both of them, and when I got to the museum, they're both on the wall, and their pictures were right next to each other, and it was just a stunning moment for me to stand in front of those photos of these two men, the great Vermonters who have served our country. You mentioned the Civil War. John, tell us about Vermont's role and Vermonters in the Civil War.
Well, Vermonters were highly looked favorable for a sharpshooter role. And one of the things that they did is they staffed a number of companies of Berdan sharpshooters. We have a list of the companies that were formed by Vermonters. There was actually a recruiter that would come around from Colonel Berdan to Vermont to enlist these sharpshooters in the Union Army. They were kind of considered the elite troops of the Union Army, and so where they came to Vermont to look for them.
Wow. And there's also a library there. I keep mentioning that, you know, the museum, but it is the Vermont National Guard Library and Museum. And, Dick, it's packed with books. What is there, and who can access those military books?
Any visitor can access those books. Primarily, the books are historical. I should say, going in, we often get requests for military records and those kinds of things. We do not have those. Those kinds of records are held at the St. Louis Archives in Missouri. But in our library, we have some, newspaper articles from the particularly World War II era, and just a scattering of all kinds of historical books that date back probably, oh my gosh, Civil War and going forward. There must be 900. Well, John can tell better, but there's probably 1,000 books in there.
Is that about right, John?
Yes, there's a lot. Yeah. I would 9,000 would not be totally off the wall.
Oh, wow. And John, how about one more conflict that you really love, you know, to kind of let people know about Vermonters and their role in it?
Well, World War One, Vermonters again did service. Again, National Guard was called up. They were called up, and they got most of them were put in the 43rd Infantry Division. Again, it's kind of like considered the New England Infantry Division. Mm-hmm. And then shipped over to France, and they were because of their especially before it became mobile. The war, they were made the ammunition depot battalion for the 43rd because they needed to keep the ammunition going to the front line. Actually, there's a photograph at the museum, a well-known photograph, actually shows the Vermont unit at the front in World War One.
All right. And, Dick, if someone has a group or wants to come visit, wants to learn more, where do they call? What are the hours that you're open there?
Well, again, the hours are Monday through Friday, 10 to 3, and they can call us directly at 802-338-3360 and let us know they're coming or just show up at the door and be happy to have them here. And I should mention that the museum lives on donations alone, even though the utilities and the buildings are provided by the National Guard graciously. Everything else is financed by visitors that come through. And again, the admission is free.
And anything, any special events happening around Wednesday, Veterans Day?
Not here today, no.
Gotcha. All right. We have a call, but it looks like I'm not sure we're going to have time to get Randy in. So, Randy, sorry. I appreciate that you called this morning. I do want to thank my guests, though. Dick Lorenz is president of Vermont's Military Museum at Camp Johnson. John Danley is the museum's docent. And I want to thank you both for joining us this morning on Vermont Viewpoint.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Take care. Now, coming up on Vermont Viewpoint, we're going to talk with folk singer Rick Pelleri. He's from Hinesburg, and he has traveled the world with folk music. He's been with Pete Seeger, Utah Phillips, and a bunch of other luminaries, and we're going to hear his story and about his new book called Banjo Man here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's 9:31.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We'll talk about a life well lived. Our next guest got swept up in music in his youth and then was carried into many far-flung parts of the world, teaching, entertaining, and learning along the way. He traveled and played with Pete Seeger, Utah Phillips, and so many others. Joining us is Rick Pelleri of Hinesburg. And Rick, thanks for joining us on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Well, I am honored to be back on WDEV and have a chance to talk with you, Rick.
Absolutely. Rick has a new autobiography out. It's called Banjo Man, Adventures of an American Folk Singer. And you can call in to ask Rick a question about his experiences or maybe share stories of having seen him and Pete playing together. Our numbers are 244-1777 or toll-free. It's 877-291-8255. Rick, take us back to that kid in New Jersey who was found by music. How did it happen?
Well, you know, I think that you know, I started off with a lot of musical failures, Rick. You know, that's the problem. it started off with the idea of, you know, my mom being from Poland and dragging me to these, you know, polka events when I was a young kid, and watching the guy play the saxophone. And I love the idea of a saxophone. And so when I was a little kid, I wanted to play the saxophone. And I was too little for a saxophone, of course, so they gave me a clarinet. Well, you can't play Woolly Bully on a clarinet, can you, Rick?
No, I don't think so.
So I tried to play the clarinet, and that didn't work out too well because it just wasn't working. And then I had tried to be in a drum and bugle corps. And I, you know, all the cool kids were, you know, in the drum and bugle corps playing drums. So I thought, man, I would learn how to play the drums. But all the cool kids, of course, got the drums, and they ended up handing me an old baritone horn that when you opened up the case, you could smell years of spit. They weren't very good on instruction at that time, but they were good on marching. So I was good on marching, but I didn't really know how to play this horn. So I found out years before Milli Vanilli that it was better to not play but to hold the instrument and march in the parade. But I felt like, oh, this wasn't working, you know. And then there was the electric guitar, and I didn't know. I got an electric guitar, but I didn't know anything about playing the guitar, so that was a musical failure. So by the time that I was in my teens and the idea of playing the banjo came around, my mother reminded me of all my musical failures, and she was not thrilled with the idea of me playing the banjo. But she did say, okay, you know, you can, I'll let you play the banjo if you take lessons. And I took this lessons in New Jersey. You know, when I got there, they said, you know, we have all kinds of banjos here. You know, we have, you know, 4 strings and 5 strings, even a 12-string banjo. And being, you know, 15 years old, no, I was gravitating to the idea of a 12-string banjo. But they said, no, all we have really here is a 4-string right now. And so I got this 4-string banjo. And the guy who was trying to teach me didn't have a banjo, but a Les Paul electric guitar. This was not going well, Rick. And so one day I saw that Pete Seeger was on TV. It was, my friend Mike Roba told me about Pete Seeger. I didn't know about this guy, and there he was on Sesame Street, and he had this 5-string banjo. I went into for the lesson, and I told the guy, I saw this guy, and he had a 5-string banjo. That's what I want. And he said, kid, you learn how to play this 4-string. Well, just drill a hole in it and stick another peg. He didn't know anything about playing the banjo, and so I quit. My mother really was frustrated with me at that point, but I actually had a plan. I had a plan that I was going to get a 5-string banjo, and I started saving up my lunch money when I was a kid. I stopped really eating, and any money that I could get, I was saving up for my banjo, and I got a Pete Seeger instruction book, and I started learning, teaching myself just by reading the book and visualizing a banjo and you know, doing the hand motions on my pillow or on a desktop at school. And then a banjo that was never bought, an old Gibson Mastertone long neck banjo, turned up. And I was only $50 short, and I begged my mother, and she gave in. And that's where it all started.
Wow.
And I, you know, Pete was on TV doing the song, Rainbow Quest is what he was, the name of the show. And I would watch Pete all the time and go to these different, you know, concerts of folk music, and I just fell in love with folk music at 15 years old.
Wow. So finally, a musical success for the very hungry young Rick Polari. what was it that then took you around the country and the world performing at schools?
Well, you know, I ended up, you know, playing with Pete by the time that I was 20 years old.
Mm.
And I started, you know, getting involved in folk music festivals. I started producing festivals and doing all kinds of things. And I saw a National Geographic magazine that had a picture of a Polish bagpiper on it. And it was like, wow, I never saw an instrument like this. And I started thinking about, wouldn't it be cool to learn how to play this instrument and actually contribute to the folk music, tradition by playing something that is from my background. And at the time, it was just a crazy dream. But eventually, it took a long time, but I did get invited to Poland in 1980 and met with a great a musician named Jusuf Broda. And he basically told me, we don't teach bagpipes to tourists. No, if you are sincere, you must come to Poland and live here and be like us.
Wow.
And so I went back home, and I was trying to play this bagpipe, and Pete Seeger wrote me a nice letter, and he said that he saw that I was trying to play this instrument, and he realized that it was important that I learn how to play it right, and he said, if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know. And so I got this idea of getting a grant to live in Poland and learn from Jusuf Broda. And Pete wrote a personal letter to the Polish government, and in 1984, I went and lived in Poland and learned from Jusuf Broda and all these Polish bagpipers. And at the end of my fellowship, they called me in and said, you know, we can't say that you have to do this, but it'd be really great if you could take this music and introduce it to the American people, because at that time under communism, the idea for people to travel in America was difficult. And so I found out about the National School Assembly Program. I did an audition, and I passed the audition. And then for the next 4 years, I guess, I was out on the road playing for thousands of school children every day, because... You know, you had four shows a day, and each school had, 300, maybe sometimes 500 kids in there. And so I was reaching an incredible amount of kids. And so that was the beginning of me traveling across the country and planting these little seeds, about this kind of music. And, for me, Rick, at that time, I really felt like I was just representing those people that I lived with. When I put on the traditional outfit of the Polish piper and I went into these schools, it wasn't like Rick Polary. It was like the people of Istebna, Poland, were there. I was representing all of those people who couldn't be there. And it was a fantastic experience because I played in, all the lower 48 states. Every day I was doing the road, the road gigs.
Yeah. Hey, Pete, Rick, with too much detail, what is the difference between a Polish bagpipe and what we're all a little bit familiar with, the Scottish bagpipe?
Well, the Polish bagpipe is made out of a goat, and it has, only one drone compared to, the four drones, of the Scottish pipes. Yeah, and you have a very different sound. Instead of it being a high pitched sound, it's a lower sound, and it's played with a bellows, like a fireplace bellows. So it's more like an Irish bagpipe, but it's very different from there. But Rick, the whole thing is that there were bagpipes, and still are, all over the world, and every country had a bagpipe, and they have bagpipes in Sweden, and they have bagpipes over in France, and in Germany, and all of these countries, and each one is different. They're all different. The Italians have a Zampogna bagpipe, very different kind of sound than this Polish pipe. And the Polish pipes date back to about the 15th century. They have a wide variety of variations of these different pipes. And I have five different types of Polish pipes that I still play.
Incredible.
Mostly the one that I play is the one from Istebna, the Gajda.
Nice.
So that was sort of that beginning of the traveling around this country. And I was also, when I wasn't performing that music, I was meeting with American folk musicians like Jimmy Driftwood, who wrote The Battle of New Orleans. I was meeting with Kevin Locke, one of the great Native American flute players. All of these different musicians that I was coming into contact with and playing music with, and Utah Phillips. And that was propelling me on a whole different kind of route, you know, of getting my music out there, my music. You know, I mean, I had been playing my own compositions as well. So that it was, I was kind of living this double life of being in the schools, playing the Polish bagpipe, then playing American traditional folk music and my own music as well when I was out on the tours.
Rick Polary is with us. I'm going to take a break here, Rick, and then we'll come back and hear more about Banjo Man and your touring. Rick Polary with us till 10 this morning. He's regaling us with tales from his life and his new book. And you can call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 to speak with Rick. And we're going to take a break, but we're going to hear some of Rick Polary and a song that has great meaning to him, "The Road Is My Mistress."
My mistress, siren of darkness, cloaked in black midnight, she bids me from home. In arms ever winding, I'm lost in her magic, destined to follow wherever she roams. Goodbye, New England, I'm off on your highway.
Rick, you had that wonderful relationship with Pete Seeger. So what was he like and what did he mean to you?
Well, Pete was just exactly as you picture him to be. You know, sometimes you meet your mentors and you get disappointed. You certainly didn't get disappointed with Pete. He was a wonderful man and he was a great teacher. My fondest memories with Pete are up at his house in Beacon, New York. I used to drop in when I was on the road. He would always welcome me over there. He had a log cabin and a little kind of farmhouse up on top of a mountain in Beacon with the worst driveway that you can imagine. In fact, he had some signs congratulating you for making the climb up to his house. And which leads me to the idea that anybody worth visiting has a bad driveway. and he, we would go up at his house and talk, and we did many projects together. I started doing a television show that was modeled after his Rainbow Quest show here in Vermont called Songwriter's Notebook. Mm-hmm. I started that in 1999. And I had a lot of different guests on there, like Margaret MacArthur, Rachel Bissix, and John Gilmore. And then we had Utah Phillips, and Pete was on the show. And he actually ended up being on my show a couple of different times. And so, you know, I would come up to his house to do these interviews. So I had like 5 hours of interviews with Pete, talking on all different topics. And that's why I say that, you know, he was, and I, in my mind, his spirit still lives on and gives us a lot of hope. I'm sure that he's smiling right now with the way things are finally going in the country. And hopefully that the country is going to come back together. And Rick, it's so important that we realize, being somebody who loves America like I do, and traveled all over this country, there are a lot of wonderful people, good people all over this country. And I do believe this country will heal, and hopefully we'll all be able to get back together and sing in harmony, as Pete would say. So that's you know, I think that to illustrate one example, all right, I'm driving down the highway, and I call Pete up and I said, "Pete, I'm coming over." He says, "Well, Rick, you know, Toshi's not here, that's his wife, but I've got a potato. Why don't you come over? We'll have lunch." So I come over, and Pete has one potato, right? And he slices the potato out, and we put some butter on it. We put it in the oven, And we each have a half a potato, and we're sitting there swapping stories back and forth. And you would think that we were having a king's banquet there with this, you know, one half of a potato. And that's what Pete was all about, you know, is about the small things in life and how precious they were. And just, you know, the joy of living. And without Pete, I would not have been able to do any of the things that I did.
Splitting a potato with Pete Seeger. What a great story. Hey, we're almost out of time, but you have traveled so far with music. But do you have a favorite place that you got to visit through all this, Rick?
Gee, I mean, it's hard to say. It's usually wherever I am is but I do have a lot of great friends in different pockets all over the world, in Australia, over in Germany, in Poland, of course, and here in the United States, in Arizona. I have a lot of great friends in Arizona and Arkansas. And you know, in Nashville, Tennessee, I spend a lot of time in different parts of the country. But you know, right now I'm really concentrating on right here in Vermont, of doing my TV show, my radio shows, and different things that benefit our community. Because as great as it is to be a traveler, you have to come home. And you have to start thinking about what can I do in my community. So that's why I've been working with up until the corona hit the Great Vermont Barn Dance Show, which was featuring a lot of different Vermont performers, my TV show, radio show called Folk Talk. I do live streams now, and it really is about celebrating where we live and our musical community.
Absolutely. Very quickly, so is there, do you miss being on the road, though, Rick? You're kind of in, you know, in Vermont now. Do you miss the road?
Well, yeah. It's tough being out here on the road, living in 100 towns every week, not knowing a friendly soul to laugh with or cry with. Nighttime is worst of all, as you really feel truly alone. Passing through the small towns, you see some of the houses have their living room or bedroom drapes pulled wide open. Riding by, you get a peek into the lives of the people inside. Yeah. So that's just a brief little story from my book. But the thing is that I really do miss the road, but, you know, I'm really happy to be here. And people can go to my website at rickpolary.com to find out more about my book.
Absolutely. And we probably covered about 6 pages of the 530 pages in the book. Rick Polary, folk singer from Hinesburg, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
All right. Take care. All right.
Bye.
We'll be up with a group from Everybody Wins Vermont in the next hour. So stick around for Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV. It's 10 o'clock.
WDEV-FM Warren. 96.5 W243 AT Berry. 98.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm your host, Rick Singeri. Reading is that avenue for many of us to explore new worlds, travel the globe, and to learn new concepts. Not all of us develop a love for reading early on, but there is a mentoring organization here in Vermont that fosters that in children in a rather interesting way, and it's called Everybody Wins Vermont. Joining me now to talk about the work of this nonprofit is the executive director, Beth Wallace. Good morning, Beth.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing today?
Fabulous. And Todd Allen. Todd has been a mentor at White River School for 5 years, is the vice president of Muscoma Wealth Management, and it's nice to have you on Vermont Viewpoint, Todd.
Thank you, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you've been a reading mentor with Everybody Wins or any program, tell us what your mentee got out of it and what you yourself learned. You can call us at 244-1777. Toll free, the number is 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Beth, tell us how Vermont, Everybody Wins Vermont typically works and what the goal of the program is.
Sure. Everybody Wins is a reading mentoring program. So we match citizens who apply to be mentors. We screen them, we train them, and we match them one-on-one with a child in their local school to read over lunch and recess, typically at school, during the school day once a week. We have site coordinators in each school, so it's a supervised program, and the mentor comes in and reads with their mentee every week. They might play games. They might have conversations, talk about life. It's really a friendship that centers around language and centers around books, and that's how it typically works.
What can you tell us about the role Jim Jeffords played in this program?
Well, Jim was one of the first people to go to visit the very first Everybody Wins program, which was in New York City. It has a different name now. It's called Read Ahead, but it's the same program. And Jim, when he was a senator, went and visited the Everybody Wins program in New York, and he was so impressed that he brought it back to Vermont, back to D.C., and started the Everybody Wins D.C. program, which is still going strong. And he read himself, and his staff read. So his staff has been telling me stories in the last year. I've been fortunate enough to talk with some of them of how he would just shut down a committee hearing and say, got to go read now. You know, Tiffany's waiting for me.
Yeah.
And his whole staff would just take off and go to the local elementary school and read to kids for 45 minutes and then come back to Capitol Hill. So it was Jim and his staff that brought the program to Vermont, and in particular the first director of the program was Lisa Christie, who worked with Jim and to bring the program here to Vermont.
Todd, what drew you into becoming a mentor with Everybody Wins?
I first learned about Everybody Wins at a Rotary Club meeting. I'm a member of the Rotary Club of Hanover, New Hampshire. I live in Hartford, Vermont. And Beth came and spoke. Another member was a mentor. And so Beth came and talked about Everybody Wins to the club. And it's once a week. It's over lunchtime. I had the time. My schedule was flexible enough to do it. And programs for children has always been important to me. I used to be very associated with a YMCA camp in northern Wisconsin. Was on the board there, and so I like to support programs that help with young people.
Well, Todd, you also served as the board president. Why has this organization been one that you really wanted to be so much a part of?
Well, I think one, reading is really important, for the development of your kids. I have two grown daughters who read extensively, and we read extensively to them. And they've gone on to have, great lives, great careers. And so I think, to try and help someone out in doing that is great. And also just making a connection with a child. Typically, it's anywhere from a first grader up to a sixth grader, and you like to try and stay with the student year by year. And so I've worked with my first student I mentored for 3 years in a row, and we developed a relationship, and that was really a lot of fun.
Beth, how many children are usually in the program?
In a typical year, we have over 600 children reading with mentors around the state. We have 22 sites around the state, and 600 mentors and kids reading together every single week.
Now, we keep talking about in a typical year. This is certainly atypical. Normally, you go into the school and meet with your child over lunch. But how are things being handled now due to COVID?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. Our program is entirely remote this year. Like many, many organizations, we closed in mid-March last year, just before the schools closed down. And we immediately started thinking about our kids and our who had just said goodbye to their mentors. In fact, most of them didn't get a chance to say goodbye. So we have a summer pen pal program every summer, and we opened that program up right away in April, and we had over 800 exchanges between children and mentors in the first month alone. So emails, videos, letters back and forth, people sent pictures. It was really quite amazing. We also give every child two free brand new books every year because so many children, especially children in poverty, don't have books at home. So it's really special for them to have books that belong to them and that are chosen specially by their mentor or by their coordinator. So last spring we mailed all those books, sent them all out to U.S. mail, and got lots of thank you notes back from kids who really appreciated getting something special in the mail with a note from someone who cared about them. And then we started a remote mentoring pilot. We used a few different platforms. We tried different ways of having kids and mentors meet online with a select group of mentor pairs over the summer. We chose Zoom, and now this year all of our mentoring is remote. So we have kids and mentors meeting once a week remotely through video. In fact, Todd has done it. You can ask Todd. He's meeting with his mentor, his mentee remotely. And it's in about 14 of our typical 21 sites. So there were some schools that just felt they couldn't manage another thing this year, which you can completely understand. But we have set up those reading sessions in 14 different sites around the state. And we have, I think we're creeping up on 100, 150 mentor pairs at this point.
Todd, how is that going, and how is it different from what you've experienced in the previous years?
It's going remarkably well, Rick. We use the Everybody Wins staff has provided a lot of resources for mentors to connect with the students, even though it's remotely. So I have a website that I can go to, then I can go pick out books, and then use the browser to share my screen with my mentee, whose name is Henry. He's a second grader. And so Henry can see the books, and right now we're going with books that have illustrations as well as the written word. So he follows along. So it's going well, but it's difficult. You're not really making that personal connection. Henry's a new mentee for me, so I've not personally met him. It's only been on a computer screen. But he seems to enjoy it a lot, and it's a little bit more convenient for me. I can just do it straight from my office. I don't have to go to the school. But I'm looking forward to, when times are right, getting back and developing more of a personal relationship with him.
What have you all heard from former Everybody Wins Vermont mentees about what the program has meant to them? Beth?
Oh, I have a great story for this. We have a young woman in Rutland. Her name's Kayla. And Kayla was a mentee when she herself was a child, when she was 8 at Rutland Intermediate School. And what she says about that is that she did not like to read when she was 8. And then she had her mentor, who is Sue Ahern, who's still a mentor. He's been a mentor for almost 20 years in the program down there. And it completely changed her life. And she went to Castleton State and graduated with an RN degree in nursing, which if you know anything about degrees in nursing, you have to read a heck of a lot. She says that reading is her favorite thing. And now she's a pediatric nurse at Duke. And that's, I think, the kind of change that Everybody Wins can have for kids. We have numbers and numbers of stories like that. Some kids who say, I wasn't going to be able to transition into the next grade with my class, or, everybody else could read and I couldn't read. I just didn't like it because I wasn't good at it. And I think what mentoring does is to help children love language and love books so that they want to read. It takes the weight off them. The emphasis in our program is never on making a child read, because you know, there's plenty of that in school where they really need to, they need to perform, shall we say, in school. But in Everybody Wins, that's not the point. In Everybody Wins, the point is to have adults read to children so that children can absorb the language and the story and the jokes and just have a really good time. And what we know from research that when adults read to children, when an adult that you care about reads to you, that that produces oxytocin in your brain. It actually produces oxytocin, which is a pleasure chemical in everybody's brains, the adult and the child. But so over time, if the child has that pleasurable experience of being read to by somebody who cares about them, then they, that creates a pleasure loop, really, in their brain, where reading is enjoyable and reading is pleasurable. And we have heard a lot of stories from parents. We surveyed all of the participants in our program every year, and so we get a lot of stories from parents saying things like, I came down the other morning at 6 o'clock and my son was already up and he was reading on the couch. That never happened before. My child wants to go to the library on the weekend. He never used to want to go to the library. You know, I sent my daughter in to clean her room, and I went in to check on her 15 minutes later and she was reading a book. You know, it's that we hear those stories over and over and over again. Hmm.
Our guests this morning are from Everybody Wins Vermont. Beth Wallace is the executive director. Todd Allen is a reading mentor. And I had the privilege of reading with a child through Everybody Wins Vermont for 3 years. And it was a rewarding experience. In the earliest days, he would spend a lot of his time looking out the window, watching his classmates on the playground. And within a few months, every Wednesday, he would tell his teacher, "This is the day Rick comes in." We went from picture books and I Spy through Mr. Pinkwhistle, Lemony Snicket, and Gregory Maguire's The Hamlet Chronicles, which made him laugh out loud. But our favorite book was always Dear Mrs. LaRue. It was letters written from a dog that had been sent off to obedience school. With me to talk about Everybody Wins and what it's like to be a mentor are Beth Wallace and Todd Allen. And you can join the conversation or ask about this literacy program by calling 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Todd, who would be a good fit to become a mentor with a program like this?
Well, a lot of the mentors at the White River School, and I'm sure probably the other schools that are in the program, are retirees. They're people that have flexible schedules and, you know, want to give back to their community. And that's pretty much the case. You know, I'm in my 60s, but and I, as I said earlier, I've got a very flexible schedule, so it's easy for me to take 1 hour a week and do the mentoring. Down here in the Upper Valley, we actually get a lot of Dartmouth Tuck students, the business school at Dartmouth. Tuck students have been volunteering to mentor, and they'll do it for a couple of years while they're at school. And I've even heard stories of some Tuck graduates who come back and continue to mentor. Perhaps they, you know, take a job in Boston or maybe somewhere else in New Hampshire, and they still want to come back and mentor. And that really speaks to, you know, the gratification, and just it's such a great program that people would want to do that.
Beth Wallace, how is the program funded?
That's a good question, Rick. Like a lot of small nonprofits, we have a patchwork of all kinds of funding. The biggest chunk of our funding comes from Mentor Vermont, which is the overall mentoring organization in the state of Vermont. And that money comes from the Agency of Human Services and other funding from that Mentor Vermont gets. So that's a chunk of our funding. We have a lot of donations from individuals. We have individuals who donate anywhere from $5 to, you know, $1,000 or more every year. So there's about 500 people that contribute to Everybody Wins every year. That's a really significant amount of our funding. We get foundation grants. We work with businesses that sponsor events, or also I think it's always really important to talk about the phone company Consolidated, which has donated our space in Montpelier, our office space, for 20 years now, which is a really significant annual donation for us. I think it's fair to say that the organization probably wouldn't still exist without that, you know, constant donation. We know we have a place to be We know we have an office that we can work out of. Lots of civic organizations. I mean, Todd mentioned the Hanover Rotary. The Hanover Rotary has donated to Everybody Wins for several years now in a row. And then schools and towns. We are on the ballot for town appropriations in some towns where we have programs in the school. And then most schools donate something towards the cost of the program in their school. What that amount is really varies a lot depending on the school. So it's a pretty wide range.
Todd Allen, you don't keep spending a lunchtime a week during the school year for 5 years unless you're enjoying yourself. So tell us about the experience from a mentor's perspective.
Yeah, I've definitely enjoyed myself. I've had now, I'm on my third mentee, third student. And so they're all different. All of my mentees have really enjoyed reading, which is great. And as Beth said, this isn't a mandatory program. It's something that kids, they want to do it. In fact, at the White River School, it's kind of the cool thing to do. Almost every student at the White River School is involved in a program, and it's the state's largest program. But to get back to your question, there's just, making that connection with a young person, seeing the world through their eyes, being able to touch base with them, talk to them about how their week's going. Recently, we just had Halloween, so I asked Henry, I asked him what he was for Halloween and did he have candy, and he said, yeah, I've got candy, but my parents had hid it from me. So you get those kinds of little stories, and it's a slice of life that just, and it's such an easy thing to do. It's just take an hour from lunch and go and spend some time with someone. So it's really easy and fun.
Beth, what kind of feedback do you receive from teachers and from school administrators?
Well, extremely positive feedback. I mean, we survey those folks along with everybody else, and so we have a pretty good idea of what they think of the program, as well as just anecdotally talking to folks. But, we know that, for example, something like 70 to 80% of teachers will tell us that the kids who are in the program significantly improved in their desire to read, significantly improved in their ability to discuss books and ideas, significantly improved in their reading ability. So we know that teachers and schools see significant academic improvement on the part of kids who are involved in the program. The comments that we get, though, are really heartwarming. There are a lot of what teachers see in students is kids who want to come to school because their mentor is coming that day. And they'll say things like, she doesn't always want to come to school, but on Wednesday she is always there. She never misses a Wednesday because that's the day her mentor is coming. So I think teachers and principals see the difference that having an adult show up for a child every week at school, having an adult who comes just for you to see you at school, is a really powerful, powerful experience for a young child. And I think the other thing that's important to note is that we have a standing list of schools that would like to have Everybody Wins programs at their school. I mean, we are in 21 schools in a typical year. We're in 21 schools in the state. But, there are over 300 elementary schools, and several of them, many of them, are on the list. They've called us and said, hey, we'd really like to have Everybody Wins in our community, too. And so that tells you something, that it's a program that people would like to have in their school. And if we had the funding, we'd be in every school in Vermont.
Yeah. I remember when I started, my mentee was in third grade, and we were together then for the 3 years, third through fifth. But I remember I had grand plans, and I kept thinking, okay, well, we'll read this and this, and I'll get him on to Harry Potter, and we'll read this. And we'd go to the book cart every week, and he would pick a picture book, or he'd pick an I Spy book. And I kept thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing wrong? We should be reading, I'm sure he can read chapter books. He talks about these others, but we'd go back to the cart and he'd pick the same type of books every week. But one week he went to the cart and he pulled a book and he said, let's read this one. This one's fun. And that was it. That was the light bulb moment for me, mm-hmm. realizing, right, that it's all about not worrying about the reading ability, the reading level, but making it fun for the child to read a book with someone. Right, Beth?
Absolutely. That's exactly the key. And one of the things that we know about children and books is that they go back to favorite books, right? They go back to things that are comfortable for them and are familiar for them. And schools, I mean, quite rightly, like, this is not a criticism, but schools are about helping kids advance, right? Finding their growing edge, finding their learning edge, and helping them do the next hard thing. And mentoring doesn't have to be about that. It can be about reading an iSpy book and just enjoying that time with your mentor. A lot of kids don't get to have conversations with adults where an adult is really paying attention to them and it's really an equal conversation. There's really somebody asking them questions and listening to their responses and feeding off them. A lot of kids don't get to have experiences playing games with adults where they're really taking turns and going back and forth and having, again, a conversation about the game that is comfortable and fun as opposed to, you know, competitive necessarily. So those experiences are really important in language development. And so what we're trying to do in Everybody Wins is give kids experiences that they might not have had or they might not have had a lot of, because those kinds of experiences are what really help kids develop a facility with language, and having a facility with language is what helps them want to read and read better.
Todd, can you think of a book or series that you've come to love because of the program?
Well, I'm reading this series called The Bad Guys right now with Henry, and it's got some very funny pictures, and it's got some very funny text, so I've, you know, it's very oriented towards, you know, a second grader or a third grader. It's not great literature, but there's a great sense of humor to it, and I've come to really enjoy it. And it's a series, and we've read, I think, now maybe three in a row. And again, I'm checking out a book from the Green Mountain Library Consortium online, and the next book in the series last week wasn't available. And so I looked at Henry through the computer, and I said, you know, Henry, what do you want to do? And he said, well, let's see what is available. So we're actually, I think, skipped ahead two books in the series because he just wanted to keep doing it.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And it really is. I want to kind of reiterate something that Beth said. Everybody Wins is a literacy-based mentoring program, but it doesn't mean that you're always reading. We play games when we're together physically at the school. There's a cart that has a bunch of games that you can take down to the room and play. So it's a combination of reading, conversation, playing games, interacting, and really whatever the child wants to do. So Henry and I will read a chapter or two, and I'll say, you want to take a break and play a game? And he goes, sure, and we play a game, and then he goes, let's go back to the book. So it's really making sure that the kid, that the student is having a time is really important.
Yeah. Beth, how can somebody get involved with Everybody Wins Vermont?
Oh, that's really easy. We have an online application. It's linked on our website. So you just have to fill out the online application. You can certainly call us or email us if you have any questions, but the application is pretty straightforward, and we'll take it from there. We'll do the screening. We have somebody who will contact you. They'll set you up with your site coordinator, and your site coordinator will take care of orienting you and matching with children.
Beth Wallace is the executive director of Everybody Wins Vermont. Todd Allen from Muscoma Wealth Management has been a reading mentor for the past 5 years and has served as the board president. I want to thank you both for the work you're doing and for being with us this morning.
Thanks for asking us, Rick. It's really been a pleasure.
Sure. After the CBS News update, we'll be back to talk about another of my favorite subjects, and that's food.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. For the final half hour today, we'll be chatting with two people who have been keeping you posted each week about the most delectable dining spots around the state and how to turn some of the state's rich bounty into delicious meals. Joining me is 7 Days food writer Sally Pollack. Good morning, Sally.
Hi. Hi.
That's better. And Melissa Passanen, also a food writer with 7 Days, and she's the author of a new cookbook, The Little Local Vermont Cookbook, Recipes for Classic Dishes. Great to have you here, Melissa.
So great to chat with you again, Rick.
And we'll be talking with Sally and Melissa about where to eat, especially affordably, and what you can create as we enter this winter of COVID. We're losing some of the outdoor dining options we've had this summer and fall. So where can we find some great and interesting to-go grub or to make at home? Listeners, time to give us a call with your questions or suggestions at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Melissa, what have you noticed about how people's eating habits have changed since March?
Well, I mean, everyone is, well, I shouldn't say everyone. A lot of people are cooking more at home, right? But also, I think takeout, people are doing takeout. I was just talking with Neil Thor, co-owner of Scale, the Poke Bar that's in Williston. They're working on some exciting new news. They're doing great with takeout, he said. So, there's a lot of different takeout options, I think, both from places that folks are used to taking out from and also restaurants that maybe are not normal takeout destinations.
Sally, are we eating different things, trying different things, going back to old favorites and standards? What are we doing?
Well, I think that I can tell you what I've been doing. I actually think just anecdotally it's been a little bit harder to find, and that is meals that cost what we call dining on a dime at 7 Days, but they're meals that cost $12 or less. And again, this is anecdotal, but it seems to me, and I think it makes sense because customers are fewer, that prices have gone up. But I still have found, and so has Melissa Passanen and Jordan Barry, who I work with, great meals and great sort of adventures to go on, sort of seeking that out. And it's fun to do, both in the looking and then when you get there in the eating.
Yeah, you've been getting...
One place that's...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, as an example would be Stone Soup in Burlington, which has had to change more than... You know, everyone's made changes, but their whole setup was that people could serve themselves from this hot and cold salad bars, and that's no longer an option with the regulations in place for dining out during COVID. And so the staff there will sort of make a plate for you, and they'll either do it at your direction. You could say, you know, I'll have some chicken wings, I'll have some Brussels sprouts, I'd like some beet salad, or... Which, and I did the second option, which is just let them decide. And you can spend $10 or $15 and get a plate for you. So that's an option of if you get the small, under $12 and a lot of variety and I love the food there and it's nutritious and you could eat $10 worth of sweet potatoes and kale.
Well, by letting them choose, I mean, I guess, first of all, you have to be a pretty adventurous eater or like a lot of things. But what did they throw in there for you?
I do eat pretty much everything, actually. Mm-hmm. And the choices, you can choose between vegan, vegetarian, or omnivore. I had omnivore, which meant there were some chicken wings in there, but there was also salad and I think beet hummus and macaroni and cheese with vegetables and a little bit of curry tuna salad. So it was a big variety, and it was $10. So
wow.
it was a good meal. Yeah,
that really sounds great.
Yeah, it was great.
Melissa, it is that season for comfort foods. So first of all, why do we love these dishes so much at this time of year?
Well, I mean, I was going to say comfort food means different things to different people,
true.
Right?
Yeah.
And maybe we're going to come back to this, but I just wanted to say when I'm eating out right now, I'm also really trying to travel with my food since I cannot travel actually. So I've been having real fun with, like I wrote about a short piece for that Dining on a Dime series that Sally was mentioning at Friends Nepali, which is in Winooski. It's under new ownership and just had some really interesting new taste experiences for me. This very traditional gundruk, which is made from fermented mustard leaves, was so cool.
Wow.
Emadashi, which is a national dish of Bhutan, which was this sort of tangy yogurt, very mild but delicious curry, just really fun. The global takeout dinner series that the North End Studios is organizing that pretty much every Saturday night, and different community members from everywhere from the Middle East, Ethiopia, Filipino. It's just really a very different experience and something, you know, often you can get foods that you can't get at restaurants. So I do recommend people check that out.
Well, is there a common denominator with comfort foods from all different places around the world?
Right. Well, so I think that's a really interesting thing. I mean, comfort food is what reminds you in many, many cases of, you know, comforting childhood things that you ate. And those are going to be different for folks from different cultures, obviously. But, you know, just talking about sort of New England tradition, which tends to come from sort of Western European cultural cooking recipes. I ran a recipe in this series we have called Home on the Range that actually came from a reader. And we love to get ideas from readers and listeners, of course. So please send us your ideas for your favorite comfort food dishes. But I did a slightly, tweaked version of Patty Thomas, who lives in Colchester, her zucchini hot dish, which, because, you know, that was toward the end of the summer when we all had serious gluts of zucchini. And, you know, it had cheddar cheese, and it had, actually, I love this. I remember learning this from my mother-in-law, who's a New Englander. She calls it Hamburg. Not ground beef, but Hamburg in the recipe. So, and you know, it's just, it's cheesy, it's warm, it's kind of soft. I think a lot of comfort foods are soft. I don't know if that's a thing. You know, a lot of times it was, you know, what your mom or dad or whoever made you when you were sick. You know, for me, that growing up, that was often chicken soup, being Jewish American. And then I did another recipe recently that was sort of one pan roasted chicken thighs with a little bit of baked kind of braised potatoes and some kale. And that was kind of soft and also a little bit garlicky and comforting. But I think comfort means different things. What about you, Rick? I know you have some strong food affinities. What's your comfort food?
Well, a couple things. I love going back to a simple dish that Mom always made, which was sausage and then in potatoes in the same pan. And you kind of cook them together, and then you get them nice and kind of caramelized at the end with some baked beans on the side. But one other variation of it that I had the other day for the first time in decades is instead of the sausage, you use hot dogs. And it's funny how this comes back to you. I remember as a kid, my mom told me, this is what the cowboys eat. And that was what made me eat it and love it. Not that I'd ever be a cowboy, but
yeah, Rich, you're such a cowboy.
Yeehaw. It was fabulous. I've got to say, it was so great to have. Hey, Sally, give us another inexpensive meal. Dine on a dime for us.
Well, M Saigon, which is a Vietnamese restaurant on Shelburne Road, sort of right at the Burlington, South Burlington border, has a, it's dining on half a dime. A banh mi sandwich, which is a sort of traditional Vietnamese sandwich, for $4.95. And, you know, it's the size of a hoagie, if people can picture that. And we had ours with, I had one with tofu, and it was just delicious. And they put hot chili, sort of sweet hot chili sauce on it, because I asked not to have mayonnaise, and there's vegetables on it, and it was just great, you know. And there's also, we've always been a fan of their soups. But this was, you know, we were seeking out a less expensive meal, not in the meat soups, but, you know, $10 or $12. It's also very affordable. So that's a really good one. And, oh, the great sort of expedition. It's not a far away. It's not like traveling to, as Melissa was talking about, for global cuisine, but we make an expedition out of going to Shelburne Farms, which has been really a steady kind of shopping experience for us this summer and into the fall. There's a 7-acre organic farm garden there that typically produces food for diners at the inn. And this year, because the inn and all farm buildings are closed, that garden, and there's also a bunch of hoop houses, is the vegetables and herbs and flowers are being sold at the farm store, outside the farm store, as well as eggs and beef raised on the farm, and of course cheese and maple syrup. So, and it's just, they're beautiful, beautiful vegetables, and going well into December, maybe right up to the end of the year, I was told. And in addition, to just, you can walk up and buy this beautiful produce, that the kitchen at the inn is making prepared foods that you can purchase there, too.
Wow.
And you can definitely eat inexpensively. I mean, you can get a quart of really good chili for $12, okay, that we've become fans of, as well as meat or vegetarian lasagna. I think the meat is $12 and vegetarian is $11, and, you know, it's a smaller pan than you would make at home, but, you know, I spend more on ingredients when I make lasagna than
that.
Well, I mean, I'm making a huge fan, and it's really delicious, and again, the if you get the meat, the beef is raised on the farm, and, you know, you make a meal of it with salad and bread. I think of lasagna as something of a comfort food.
Absolutely.
Actually. And very comforting when someone else makes
that's
it. You don't
right.
have to pull the noodles out of boiling water. And I've burned my hands a lot.
I get that.
And so that's a great spot. And you can take a walk. That's why I said we make an expedition out of it. You could walk from the store down to the lake a couple miles, come back and pick up your food.
That's
fabulous. Such a beautiful place to be.
Melissa, is there an ingredient that you've really grown to love during this pandemic?
Oh, interesting. I mean, I love all ingredients. I don't think anything has. I love the fact that the pandemic has caused my husband to start baking sourdough bread.
Oh, there you go.
You can count that. That's kind of new to our life. Other than that, you know, I cook a fair bit anyway.
Right.
I was excited to be able to grow my very own broccoli this year. So that was pretty exciting. And there's nothing like going out to the garden and grabbing your own broccoli. And I grew a really funky squash this year that I used it in that zucchini hot dish I mentioned, called Trombetta di Alba, and it literally looked like a musical instrument. It does that curly sort of long thing, and it was a really cool nutty squash, so that was kind of new to me this year. I had a lot of it, so that was fun. But I would say the most exciting new home food development for me this year is husband making sourdough bread, which is really delicious, I will say.
Sally, I know a lot of people remember Steve Bogart of A Single Pebble, and his legacy continues now in Stowe.
Right. There's a new, well, it opened in early September, Asian takeout restaurant called Umami, and it's owned by Aaron and Jennifer Martin, who also own another restaurant in Stowe called Plate, which is just a few doors down. And their second restaurant that recently opened was really designed with the current public health situation in mind, just as a to-go spot. And as Aaron said, it's like a little engine for food. It's just this little setup with a line, with cooking line, essentially, where three chefs are usually on the line making Chinese food to go, cooking in walks. And they kind of envisioned a to-go place without having decided what would be in it. And they thought of a lobster shack and then also a picnic plate, I think a reference to their original restaurant as well as its proximity to the Stowe Rec Path. But Aaron said when they thought about who would be there, sort of who would be cooking, there were two chefs who had trained and have a long affiliation with Steve Bogart, who founded A Single Pebble 25 years ago. And those chefs are Silas Tanner and Dusty Berard, and they're kind of using these classic recipes that Steve was known for and making this really wonderful food in this little spot right off Main Street. And I was lucky enough to have a sort of umami picnic with Steve in the park. There's a park just down the hill, and if people don't mind eating and when it's getting a little chilly, we really enjoyed it. Actually, we had the park to ourselves and just a feast of food. And I particularly really liked the hot and sour soup, which I highly recommend. Quart is a very affordable meal, actually. I think the quart of soup is $13 and easily feeds two people.
Yeah.
And we also had, you can get bao, and there's a dish named for Steve called Admiral Steve's Chicken. And so it was fun to eat a namesake.
Oh, I love it.
While we hung out.
Hey, let's take a call from Tony, who's calling in from Alberg. Tony, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Go right ahead.
I'm looking for recommendations on food that travels well. You're talking about to-go food.
Yeah.
And I travel an hour or so to get home at the end of the day, and I was wondering what I might get that would hold up well.
Tony, that is an excellent question. I know both of you have written when you've gotten some of these orders to go, and you've even kind of made the point that it probably would have been better if you were right there eating at the location and not having to cart it home. But any suggestions for Tony on what travels better? I know, Melissa, you mentioned that lasagna. That would probably be one that holds up well. But I'll start with you, Melissa.
It's actually really funny that Tony's asking this question because I actually got takeout from Single Pebble here in Burlington. Now owned by Chihu Duval, and traveled with dumplings, like dozens of dumplings, to the Cape Cod about a month ago to visit my sister and a new little baby. And I will say that the dumplings traveled beautifully. They had pre-steamed them, and then we just reheated them. And, maybe they weren't as perfect as they would have been if I'd eaten them at Single Pebble, which I cannot do right now because they're only doing takeout. But they did a beautiful job of getting this variety of really delicious dumplings for us that traveled very well.
Love it.
I might recommend dumplings from either Single Pebble or I think a lot of places do those, momos at a lot of the small Nepali-type restaurants.
Sally, what do you have for us that travels?
I was going to say that Umami, this Chinese restaurant, is, affiliate, has some background connection to A Single Pebble. One of the reasons Aaron's they moved toward opening, making it an Asian restaurant, was one reason was because the chefs love cooking that, but also because of the of packaging that kind of food. It travels really well. He said that was a major consideration. Of course, pizza travels well, but,
that's
you
right.
know, I mean, I don't mean of course, but, you know, you might want something a little more if you're looking for something a little. It was funny. I was talking a few months ago to Aaron Jovinsky, who's the chef owner at Misery Loves Company, and I picked up some to-go food there, including French fries. And when I got it, they were like, you know, these are on top, easily accessible, like, meaning eat them on the way home. Okay, and so then we got into this conversation of French fries are something you just want to eat, like, immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this whole idea of what you're talking about, you know, what travels well, you really probably might not want our old French fries. And he was talking about packaging.
I don't even want 5 minute old French
That's
fries.
That's right.
yeah, but they were delicious. I mean, they were right. I just, like, grabbed them. They put them right at the top of the bag, and, you know, half were gone by the time I got home.
That's good planning.
Minutes. But yep. he was talking about packaging. It's a real consideration now for chefs, I think, is what how do you package things and even tailoring a menu for food that will taste good in an hour. He said McDonald's had it down. Like those, you can picture the packages. They're cardboard, and then but there's also sort of air holes in them to let steam out.
Right.
So a nod to McDonald's, you know, from MLC.
Hey, very quickly. Oh, go ahead, Melissa.
I was just going to say, our colleague Jordan Barry also did a story on the new restaurant where Duino Duende was,
mm-hmm.
Which is called Cesa. And that they designed that menu, at that whole concept, knowing that they were going to be takeout for the first probably 6 to 9 months. And she, you know, everyone can read about that on 7 days. VT.com, but she said the food was great and everything was designed and very global, really interesting. Everything was designed to travel.
All right, perfect. So, Tony, some good options. Avoid the French fries, though, unless you're going to eat them on the ride home. Sally Pollock.
Tony, where do you live?
He's in Alberg, so. But we have got to go, Sal. So thanks to Sally Pollock and thanks to Melissa Passanen, both food writers for 7 days. And check out Melissa's new book, The Little Local Vermont Cookbook. That does it
thanks,
for Vermont
Rick.
Viewpoint today. Thank you. Our show is produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Peter Cormier, and I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock.